Thanks again to our callers in the first hour, and my apologies once more to Vance for not giving him enough time to make his point. I hope he gets a chance to call in again. Switching gears now, though, ever wonder about the wild and fabulous lives of UFO investigators? The parties, the celebrities, the fortunes to be made, right? Not exactly the way it is, though. It's a tough and lonely pursuit in many ways, fraught with peril for one's personal and professional reputation. One man who has managed to thread the needle and maintain a semblance of a normal life is my main guest tonight. His name is Bud Hopkins. You know him. He's a world-renowned author and UFO abduction researcher. He's looked into more than 700 abduction cases and continues to lead investigations into the systematic abduction of human beings by aliens, UFO occupants, whatever you want to call them. He's worked with more than 1,000 people who've reported experiences over the past 20 years and has always had a goal in mind of bringing objective, dispassionate scientific intelligence to the UFO abduction phenomenon. Tonight, though, a look at the personal side of his research and how he has tried to balance that research with something resembling a normal life. In a moment, life, art, and UFOs with Bud Hopkins. Stay with us. Folks, if you spend any time at all around the UFO topic, the world of ufology, you realize pretty quickly that it is characterized by backbiting and backstabbing and infighting, egos, jealousies, incredible fights and individual differences. I mean, I am proud to say, though, that I have known and admired Bud Hopkins for more than 20 years and can say without equivocation, he's one of the great gentlemen of the UFO field, and that's saying a lot, because there aren't a whole lot of those. But do you realize we've known each other for more than 20 years?
I was thinking about it. It's been a long time. Yep.
Hey, I'm so glad you're with me. I wanted to check on how are you doing, health-wise and both professionally, professional-wise as well. How's things going for you?
Well, it's always complicated. The health is not great at this point, and I've been, as many people know, fighting lymphoma for years, 11 years to be exact, and that seems to be in almost remission right now, thanks to chemotherapy and so forth, but it's sort of sapped the energy, and that's one of the serious problems I'm living with now, that the old get up and go, I guess, got up and went or something at this point. So I'm having to take things easy, but still doing my work. I'm still, of course, painting. I'm working with abductees, some very interesting new cases, but I'm doing a lot of sort of passive reading and contemplating and so forth. And partly this new situation really helped me to write my book, Art, Life, and UFOs, my memoir, because it's something I've wanted to do for years, but I guess things were going too fast for me to really have the time. And it's only in the past few years that I was able to sit down and really get the book together.
Well, I'll tell you, I finished it this afternoon. It's a wonderful book. It just humanizes the whole what it's like to jump into this particular field and then still try to balance it with any kind of a semblance of a normal life.
Well, I'm glad you liked it. It was also fun to do. I mean, I tried to make sure there was some humor involved in it, but also I wanted to concentrate a little bit on my earliest years, the childhood years, because all of that is so formative for what comes later. And in terms of the UFO side of things, I think what was a sort of a negative event that I described in the book was as a child, listening to the Orson Welles broadcast in 1938, a famous hoax about the invasion of New Jersey by Martians. And that experience, which was terrifying to me as a little child, I think sort of switched me off to any interest in the subject. And it wasn't until I was 33 years old that I paid the slightest bit of attention to it. And that was when I had a sighting myself. But the uh, the Orson Welles thing really sort of turned off, I think, a generation of Americans from taking UFO reports seriously, because everyone thought, I'm not going to be burned twice by another hoax.
Well, there are a lot of synchronicities in your life that sort of lead you down this path to where you end up, and I want to cover some of those, as well as the amazing eclectic group of people that you met over the years. But I'll start with this, and it's sort of a general question. You know, people see you at these UFO conventions, and you've been going to them for a long time and speaking at different conferences over the years, and they think, there's Bud Hopkins, the abduction guy. They don't even realize what an accomplished artist you are. And until you read this book and see who your contemporaries and colleagues are, I mean, it really doesn't set in, but you're a big guy.
Well, thanks. You know, George, one time I was invited by John Carpenter to speak at a conference, and he said, Bud, no one knows about your paintings, what they look like. He said, maybe you should show some, you know, talk about your paintings. So as a kind of private little joke, when I was introduced to speak on my subject, the UFO abduction phenomenon, I said, well, actually, John has asked me to talk about painting instead. So I have here 185 slides of my work to illustrate what I've done. And I looked over, John was standing there with his mouth open, sweating. And I did show about two or three slides of the work, and then I went back to the UFO subject. But I think I scared the daylights out of the guys. He was a very, very nice man.
I don't think anybody in the UFO field could afford one of your paintings anymore, could they? I mean, what's can you give us a number on something that you've sold that would just make my mouth
well,
drop?
Well, I've never hit really a high price range for many reasons. I think actually the UFO phenomenon and the research I was doing had a kind of negative effect on my market, because I think people were thinking, is this guy for real? Is he an artist after all? What is he? You know, but paintings were sold in the five figures. That's about where my peak. But I've sold many, many small things that were more reasonable, because I like to do a lot of little things. I have a sort of a miniaturist impulse, along with the idea of the grandiosity. I've done paintings 17, 18 feet in width. That's just because as an artist, you want to work a lot of different ways and different scale, different sizes. But I've shown regularly, and the last one-man show I had in New York was rather a while ago. I think it was 2007 or something like that. I've forgotten exactly. But at any rate, I've shown sometimes two and three times a year in different cities. So my work is widely known in many, many museums.
You know, one thing that was really a surprise to me in reading the book is you would think that artists would be open to the idea, the subject of UFOs, that they'd have some sort of artistic sensibility and be open to different kinds of ideas and influences. And yet, as you relate, there's very little of that, that you actually ran into resistance and a lack of interest in the UFO topic over the years.
Well, that's quite true. It is odd who was interested in the subject sort of more or less outside their professions. And amongst painters, I haven't found really much interest. There are some people who are extremely interested. James Turrell is one of the leading artists doing a kind of perceptual installation situation where it's a little too hard to explain right now, but he's world known, but he's extremely interested in the subject. And a number of years ago, he organized a futurist conference that was held in Freiburg, Switzerland. And I was picked by him to speak on the UFO subject as a possible major futurist issue. I mean, his interest is intense, but an awful lot of people just shrug their shoulders. One of the a writer, for instance, who I knew somewhat, Donald Barthamay, actually, I think a wonderful writer. When he read my article in the Village Voice about that very first case I investigated, the UFO landing in North Hudson Park, right across the Hudson River from Manhattan. When he read that article, he told me, he said, "Damn it, Bob, now I have to worry about, you know, my my writing, my career, my wife, my problems." And he said, "Now I got this to worry about." He said, "I'm really sorry I read it, you know." And I think that that characterizes a lot of people's attitudes, that it somehow, first of all, is so strange, so outside their experience, the existence of perhaps another entire culture, technology, race, whatever, doing its thing here. It's so outside everybody's experience, unless they've had experiences, that they just don't want to deal with it. On one side, it's just easy to avoid that way. On the other side, it's really scary to think about it. It's very disconcerting, and who wants that?
Well, it's really scary. In your book, Art, Life, and UFOs, a memoir, you sort of relate how not only is it kind of an accident that you become a UFO researcher, and we'll get into how that happened, but it's also an accident you become an artist at all. That's not what your father wanted for you at all.
Yeah. Well, I think that's quite true. I think that I really enjoyed writing about those early years and the some of the strains within the family, but also some of the joys and pleasures. And I even had a chapter about sexual awakening, which, of course, I guess is de rigueur now. You've got to do that because you don't get to be a human being without it.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, that's true. But I was thinking to myself, man, I don't think I could write this. I don't think I could be quite as candid as Bud is in revealing some of these personal side.
Well, you know, George, the funny thing is that amongst my colleagues, two UFO colleagues, two of them said to me that part of the book they made them extremely uncomfortable, and they were not they thought I should not have gone into it. And I think not going into it, because I don't go into it at any length, it's it has a lot of humor in it, I hope.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But the thing is that not going into it would have looked like a kind of a hole in the book, and people would have said, "Well, what about how do you get involved with relationships and with women he's been married and stuff? And how did that start out? You know, there has to be a beginning." And so I felt, well, it does have to be a beginning, and that has to be told. So I went into that a little bit. It's not exactly a sexual tell-all book by a long shot, but at least I covered it, and I just reread part of that today. I was kind of looking through the book, and I think that's pretty well done. It's funny, it's very hard to imagine, to reimagine somehow writing this book now, because it came, took shape over the years. But I don't know that some parts of it I could possibly match today with a slightly tireder brain or whatever.
Well, I really enjoyed those parts because they sort of tell the world how Bud became Bud. And I was just saying, man, I could never write the same thing and reveal this kind of stuff about myself. I think I'd be too self-conscious about it. But it certainly helped to create a well-rounded picture of who you are and how you became the person that you are.
Right. Well, you know, I just didn't want to leave anything out. I mean, I had this feeling, when I say anything, any kind of area that is central to how a human being becomes shaped. And so I did certainly put in most areas that I possibly could. And the funny thing is that complex thing is that my relationship with my father, and you mentioned, has not been quite pleased with my becoming an artist. He passed away before I was really deeply involved in the UFO subject. But the problems with my father, and still the love and affection that was present at the same time, is just very complex. Several people have told me, Jerry Clark, amongst others, in his review, that he thought that was the finest part of the book, in the sense that it was highly complex emotionally. There's some material there that was pretty hard to deal with. But he felt it was extremely moving, and maybe the part of the book he liked best. And the interesting thing is, that's the part that my family hates. They all feel I've revealed things that I shouldn't have revealed, I guess. So they hate the part that many people have liked the best about the book.
You grow up in West Virginia with a stern father who doesn't want you to become an artist. He wants you to join him in the auto business at some point. You go to Oberlin College. You discover art. You end up, as soon as you can, making a beeline for New York City. And it was amazing to me that you jump right into the thick of the art scene there, this Cedar Bar scene, where you meet the likes of, you meet a who's who of contemporary artists. They weren't big shots in those days, but became really well known, right? Jackson Pollock.
Yes, exactly. Well, one of the things is that when I was at Oberlin and Robert Motherill came out, one of the major figures of the abstract expressionist movement, he showed slides and talked about these paintings. This was in 1952, and it was all radically new, and I was extraordinarily excited and wanted to get to New York as fast as possible. But when I got to New York, I thought, you know, here's this this rich world of these important people, and I just thought that this is going to be one of the most glamorous things. And I found out that the entire art world was about 250 people. They all got to know virtually all of them within two or three weeks. Everybody went to the same bar. Everybody was broke. There was almost no money floating around. Nobody was making much money, even though at that point, a number of the artists were becoming very well known. Pollock is an example. So the whole world which I thought was a gigantic lake, was actually a pretty small pond at the time I got involved. So it was very easy to do. And the artists were very generous, too. I mean, they accepted I was a kid at the time, and some were very, very helpful to me. But Pollock was a difficult individual at that point.
Well, the portrait you paint of a lot of them is that, you think of the caricature of the starving artist, the troubled artist, the boozer, the drug guy. A lot of these guys fit it to a T.
Yeah, well, they weren't... drugs were not a thing that I noticed at all in the early 50s like that. But the booze, I tell you, was quintessential. And so I would say a majority of the painters really became eventually alcoholics, and of course came to very short ends. Pollock, when I got there, Pollock was really practically not painting anymore, and was really a terrible drunk. And the stories that I relay, the anecdotes of my dealings with him, because I was always trying to avoid him, because he was trouble.
Well, we don't want to dwell entirely on the art part of it. We'll come back and get a little bit more into that, and then move on to your first UFO experience and how you are led into this kind of research. Stay with us for more of an interview with Bud Hopkins here on Coast to Coast AM. My guest tonight, though, is Bud Hopkins, who was a promising but, of course, struggling artist in the 1960s. trying to make ends meet and trying to make his mark in the world. And then things changed. He saw something in the sky, didn't know it at the time, that it would sort of help carve out a path, a life path for him. When we come back, we'll get into the discussion of what he saw and how that led him to his groundbreaking work in the area of alien abduction research. Stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM. Bud Hopkins, tell me this. Prior to your August 1964 sighting, had you done any research? Had you read a bunch of UFO books? Were you into the topic at all?
I was totally not into the topic. The only topic I was deeply involved with was art, was my painting. And I knew nothing really about the subject. And because, as I mentioned, as a child, been scared to death by the invasion from Mars story, which turned out to be such a hoax of Orson Welles, I assumed that any reports that I might have even encountered back in those days, in the 50s and 60s, were hoaxes too.
But of course, you're aware of it. I mean, other people are seeing it. It pops up in the news from time to time in the late 50s and early 60s, of course.
But I paid no attention to it. It was completely just dropped.
So in 1964, you get out of New York to go to Cape Cod to do some painting and relax and just have a different kind of a scene. And you and two other people are driving down the road, 5:15 in the afternoon. What did you see?
As we were driving down, we were on a hill and we were on the high ground. And just before we started down, somebody said, are you looking what I'm looking at? You know, you see what I'm seeing? And we were all focused on this lens-shaped, metallic-looking object that didn't seem to be moving. But if it was moving, it was moving very slowly. But we were moving, so it was hard to tell. And these little clouds would blow by it, or rather fast, small clouds, and either conceal it or silhouette it, or at one point, a cloud sort of swallowed it up, and you saw a silhouette inside, like the ship in the fog kind of thing. And so we were quite fascinated and not talking, just looking at it. And as we drove down the hill, we were, of course, looking up at it more steeply. It was off to our left. And it was, you could tell, it was circular from a lower angle. And I was driving very slowly at this point, and we were all hanging out looking at it. And suddenly, whew, off it goes, and it went directly into the wind, which eliminated the idea of a balloon or something. I was trying to come up with explanations, and I hit the brakes. We all jumped out, and this thing flew straight into the clouds that were coming in from the ocean. And at that point, somebody said, do you suppose that's one of those flying saucers you used to hear about? Not that we heard anything specific. I wasn't paying attention. And we were absolutely amazed and sort of turned on. We went on to the party we were heading to, and when we went in, we started telling people about what we saw and began to hear reports from other people. Yeah, well, I saw something funny, too, right over the trees. It had windows in it. I'm thinking, what the heck is this? Is this some sort of real phenomenon that's sort of hidden, because nobody ever told me that they had these experiences. And that was, at that point, I was kind of off and running.
And at this party that you went to, I mean, it's not just beatniks and beach bums. There's some really interesting people, an artist colony sort of a thing. Mary Oliver is a name that our listeners might know.
Yes, that's right. Mary was one of the, she was a friend of mine and a poet, a marvelous poet. And she and her partner had a sighting, a daytime sighting. Some of the painters had sightings. I mean, I didn't find sightings for everybody, but certainly there were more than just one or two. And it was a rather, toady intellectual gathering. It wasn't beatniks. That hadn't happened yet.
Mary Oliver won a Pulitzer Prize, right?
Yes, she did. Mm-hmm. And she's widely published and widely admired now.
So you go around the room, you're telling this story, and you tell it to others in the course of the next couple of days. Does it occur to you, hey, wow, this is really, maybe I'm onto something here. Does it occur to you that this is way more common an experience than ever occurred to you before?
Absolutely. And I think that's something that continues with people. I've had an awful lot of people who felt they were very alone. They had some weird experience, and they finally, at some gathering or somewhere, had somebody tell them that they had the same experience in a different location. And there's this sense of amazement, like, my gosh, this is really going on. This is a real thing. And so I was just totally fascinated. And I can say, George, absolutely, when that thing zoomed away, I just didn't have the feeling that this could be from this Earth. I mean, I really did have the feeling I'm looking at some kind of extraterrestrial thing. It was, the thought was just there. And because this thing was round, it didn't have any wings or propellers or means of propulsion and whatnot that I could see, and it could hover, and then it could zoom away. And I said, Lord, this isn't something we have here.
And were you hooked at that point? You started reading a lot and investigating?
Absolutely. I was extremely hooked. I began reading everything I could. There were not that many books to read at this point, 1964. And mind you, this was all pre the Hills case, which didn't really make it to the press, to the public awareness until 1966. But just something that's very interesting is that as I was reading all this stuff, and suddenly, convinced that this is very real what I saw. And it's not from Earth. There was a CBS broadcast on the subject, a big, big special with Walter Cronkite. And every single thing was poo-pooed on this program. I remember being enraged watching it. And at one point, they had some general or somebody that Cronkite was talking to who was asked, Cronkite asked him about radar. Had radar ever picked up any of these things that were otherwise inexplicable? And he said, no, we've never had sightings that of anything like this that we couldn't explain. And I knew from even reading about Air Force accounts that there were many, many radar and radar visual reports that the Air Force officially called unidentified. So I knew this program was kind of a deliberate hoax in itself. And I found out, of course, years later that the Robertson panel, which had been put together a little earlier in the 50s by the CIA, their official job, they decided, was to debunk things and to take people's attention away from the UFO subject. And years later, one of the people in the Robertson panel wrote a letter to a friend saying how wonderfully the Cronkite program had done their job, that they had backed the whole thing, and Carl Sagan was involved with it. So I was aware at that point then that there's some official government policy to debunk and make this whole phenomenon go away, to ridicule it, because ridicule was going to be the main weapon they used, and it's been the most effective they have.
It sure has, and I want to come back to Walter Cronkite in a minute, because you actually called him up and got through and had a conversation with him about UFOs that was very revealing. But before we jump too far ahead, you eventually called the Air Force and made a report, but it was about your UFO sighting, but it was much later, right?
Right. It was the next year. What had happened, the sighting was in August of 64. When I went back to Wheeling to visit my family, my father, who was a retired colonel from World War II, actually, when I told him the story, he was very supportive, which is interesting. He had no problems with it. And he said I should write to the Air Force and report it, even though a year had passed. So I did. I wrote to the Air Force, and Otis Air Force Base on Cape Cod was where I sent it. And what I received back was a lot of boilerplate about the Air Force's job is to do this and security and blah, blah, blah. And then he said, if I had reported this in a timely fashion, it could have been investigated, but unfortunately I waited a year to report it.
So on one hand, they're saying there's nothing to this, it's no threat, we don't care about them, but by golly, why don't you report it earlier next time?
Exactly, and what they said at the very end of the letter was, if I should have another sighting, I should report it immediately to the nearest Air Force installation. And I thought, Lord, if they think there's nothing to this, if they think it's merely, old ladies hearing bumps in the attic that they call the police, they're letting themselves in for many, many, false calls and wastes of time and so forth. So it seemed to me this kind of ambiguous thing was really still asking me or anyone to report UFO sightings. So I thought, what is the Air Force's real position here?
Tell me the story about Cronkite. I guess you were prompted by something in the National Enquirer. There's some bogus story or some specious story about Walter Cronkite says, I believe in UFOs, something like that.
Yes, it was I saw this newspaper on this, on the newsstand. Big headline across the front. It was the whole page, I remember. Why I Believe in UFOs by Walter Cronkite. So I bought the thing and read it. It had just come out. And it was written as a particularly personal interview in his elegant office and so forth and so on. When I called the National Enquirer to find out more about it, they said that the writer was a stringer, was a freelancer, not part of their staff. And they gave me his number. So I called him. I just got very intrigued. And I guess the bee was in my bonnet to investigate and actually find out facts. But I called the guy. He had a strange accent I couldn't quite identify, semi-British. And he said, the whole story was true. He'd been up in the office and so forth and talked to Cronkite. And so I immediately called the CBS and not expecting actually that I'm going to talk to Cronkite. I just thought, asked for a statement. Nobody at CBS had actually read the article. I decided that there weren't many National Enquirer readers at the CBS. But at any rate, and it was also a much more suspect sheet than it is now. But what happened is somebody called back and left a number for me to call to speak to Cronkite. And through the magic of communication, suddenly there I am talking to this voice that I've heard say, that's the way it is, Wednesday. I've heard that voice so many times watching him. I was sort of stunned. I said it was like talking to God or something, the president. And he explained to me that he'd never met the writer. The writer had come up, made up of the whole cloth. But then he started asking me about my interest in the subject. And I had written this article. Of course, is a little later on in the story. But I had written this article about the UFO landing in North Hudson Park, which is how I really began investigating. That was 1976. And so he wanted to know all about it. And ultimately, I said, well, Mr. Cronkite, what do you think about the UFOs? And he said, well, on the one hand, I've had Air Force people who said that they saw it and this and that, friends who were witnesses, but on the other hand, I find it difficult to believe because, that how this could be going on and so forth. And it was, as I said in the book, it was a kind of a typical Cronkite thing. On the one hand, this, on the other hand, that, the carefully weighed. But when I ended the conversation, my wife, who had been listening to my side of it, said, she said, you didn't interview him, he interviewed you. And I realized that had happened. I hadn't thought that's what was going on, but he was interviewing me. At any rate, ultimately, I called the guy back who had written the article. And at that point, he admitted he'd never been in Cronkite's office, and this wasn't a personal interview, but he'd actually joined a table that Ron Peck was sitting at with a lot of other people in the lanes of the restaurant, and he just eavesdropped, and he put together, he claimed this is what Cronkite said, the irony of all this was that the man's name was Robin Leach, who went on to do The Lives of the Rich and Famous on television. And he sort of made a profession out of eavesdropping, in fact. And I said I wondered how, whether Leach was spelled L-E-E or L-E-A, because there's something, as I put it, he was like a paparazzi without a camera. But anyway, it got me a conversation that I hadn't ever expected with Walter Cronkite at the time.
Well, we will certainly get back into the UFO incident that occurred that led you to write your first article. But before we get that far, I want to know, after your personal sighting and you start reading mm-hmm. about it and it starts sinking into your brain, how does it affect your art? It, at some subconscious level, it starts seeping into what you're painting, right?
Well, that's something I go into and even have an illustration in the book. But as I pointed out, no artist likes to admit he was or she was influenced by somebody. You know, you want to be sui generis. It's all yourself. I wouldn't have accepted the idea that the UFO experience had anything to do with my painting, even though some other people pointed it out to me that they thought there was a definite relationship. And what happened is I started using, a big circle as a centering compositional feature in the paintings. And for the next 20 years, I hardly painted anything without a big circle as part of its central imagery. And the big circle functioned two ways. They first began, when I first started using it, the circles were always black. And there were sort of smears of activity which came into it sort of from the outside. So the black looked like a black hole. At the same time that the way it was composed, it looked like it was a black disc on top of everything else. I mean, it was this very ambiguous compositional device, which I found very fascinating, to create a hole in the painting that at the same time was something on top of everything. And so on they went, using these circles, and then I began varying the circles in color and cutting them into sections and so forth. But still denying for a long, long time that I was influenced at all by my experience.
And wasn't it the actor, Maximilian Schell, who made the suggestion, the connection?
Yes. Maximilian Schell had bought paintings of mine, and he was very interested in my work. And, of course, he knew my UFO story. I told people pretty freely about it. And so in 1968, I remember he told me that I should see the film 2001, Space Odyssey, which he said, I think it has something to do with your paintings as the UFO experience. I saw the movie and thought there was absolutely no connection. And I remember not liking the movie very much, which was maybe deliberate. But at any rate, the fact that Schell made that observation, he wasn't alone. Other people said the same thing.
And do you see the connection now? I mean, is it pretty as obvious as it? Yeah.
Yeah, I think definitely. Now, but there was one other thing, and that was this has back to my painting in general. The paintings before that were more abstract expressionist. In other words, there were elements that in a certain sense were sort of fighting each other, which was the way of Klein and de Kooning, a lot of other people were working. And there was kind of an active fight going on in the paintings to create energy, which was very, very important to me. And it was very important to abstract expressionism, the idea of velocity, of movement. And when the circles came in, things got much calmer. I moved to a more classic kind of emotional territory.
Hey, Bud, we need to take a break. Everyone stay with us. We're talking with artist and UFO researcher Bud Hopkins. And when we come back, the road to alien abduction research and how Bud ended up on that path. Stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM.